think I see it going right across my deck here now. I did not three hooks with someone right up in his vicinity, but no, I didn't.
All right, so this is Goose 2, Roger. Thanks for that information, sir, and I'll get back to you if we come up with anything, over.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Beyond the Breakers, a podcast about shipwrecks, loss, and lessons learned from maritime disasters. My name is Taylor, and I'll be one of your hosts today, and shortly I'll bring in Tanner. But first, we have a Patreon shout-out to do. Thank you, Brighton, for signing up. Hope you enjoy all of the extra features. And yeah, we're constantly working to do more content over there. If you're interested, it's patreon.com/beyondthebreakers. Check it out. With that, I'll bring in Tanner. Tanner, how you doing?
Hello. Hello. How's it going?
Oh, not too bad. It's breezy and cold, but sunny. So I will take that.
It's back to being chilly. We're kind of getting a backloaded winter this season. We had quite a bit of snow. This is after having essentially one big snowfall all winter here in Wisconsin.
I saw that like Milwaukee doubled their snow total for the year or something.
And this is right before some of my students are going back home to China. So they kind of get one last blast of winter.
Lucky them. Aside from that, I guess I am happy that the sun is shining. So as I sit in the house and watch basketball all day, I can see the sun. We are in the throes of March Madness, or as one of your students calls it,
the crazy games.
The crazy games. I love it. It's one of my favorite things every year. March Madness is great. There's already been some fun upsets. This is my media check-in, by the way. There's been some fun upsets. I think Kentucky going down was probably my favorite. Go Oakland, go Horizon League.
It's funny because that's a great little bit of American culture that I do with my students. And so, you know, the ones who want to fill out a bracket, since most of my students are from China, a lot of them are super into basketball.
I imagine this isn't basketball that they get exposed to, though, necessarily. This is something a little different.
No, but still, just because of the NBA, they're very familiar with UNC, Duke. You know, they know the big schools because they know where all these players come from.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're operating basically off of name recognition when they make their bracket, all of my students chose the Yale over Auburn upset, and all of my students chose the Grand Canyon upset because really? Those are two things that they know about America, Yale, Grand Canyon.
That is funny.
I've got quite a group of risk takers here.
They didn't know James Madison, unfortunately. They didn't get that one.
A lot of the other picks are a little bit off base, but hey, you know, you can't win them all. You got to pick the upsets somewhere in the bracket.
Right.
So yeah, like overall, mine is doing pretty good. Dayton, I think, officially just lost. So I had them.
Yes. Yes, they did.
In one of mine, in my work bracket, I think I had them in the Elite Eight as my sort of stretch goal. But
yeah, I think I maybe had a bracket where they made the Sweet 16 or something. I've seen enough of their games this year. I knew that they weren't that good.
Yeah, the Badgers, I picked them in both brackets, but like as soon as that was announced, James Madison, like they're a good team, and I knew that probably wouldn't go very well for the Badgers. Yeah,
about 5 minutes into that game, I knew that it was not going to be pleasant. They were turning it over and not hitting shots, and that's just not winning basketball.
They got bullied pretty hard in that game.
Yeah.
It was not really much of a competition. I have no problem going for James Madison the rest of the way.
It's been amusing to see what North Carolina State's done so far. I watched them run through the ACC tournament, and not a huge NC State fan, but it's been fun to watch that a team like just get hot. So I definitely wouldn't want to play them right now.
People love watching DJ Burns play basketball.
Who doesn't, right?
So yeah, it's been a fun tournament so far.
Outside of that, I've just continued to work through Battle Cry of Freedom by James McPherson, which it's just a monster of a book, but it's so good. There's just so much information in there. I don't know if you're into the Civil War. I think it's a good one to read, even if some of the information might be dated in it, since I think it was published in 88. It's still a very good book and very detailed, and it really explains a lot of the politics, internal and external, in the Union and the Confederacy that's going on. And that's something I'm not super familiar with. It does more than just talk about battles, which is really cool.
Yeah. I think those are the truly good history books, is the ones that can cover it from multiple angles.
What about you? What have you been up to?
Well, speaking of monster books, I finished Gravity's Rainbow.
Nice.
Finally. I kind of went in streaks with it. I had my 30 pages a day thing set out, and I more or less followed it, but there was a few days where I wasn't. Just did not feel like reading that book. So glad to be done with it. There were enough I think, good, memorable parts to make it worth the time. Definitely not my favorite book or a book I would probably revisit, but I can understand the appeal.
Mm-hmm.
The way I would describe it is, I think I would have enjoyed the act of reading it much more in college, but I would have understood so much less of it in college.
I don't know anything about it. Is this like, are we talking something like Infinite Jest, like that type of thing? Or
I've tried to read David Foster Wallace, but it's compared to like Ulysses, stuff like that, where it's semi stream of consciousness at times. It's the kind of thing where, you know, if a student submitted this paper to a writing teacher, they would say, well, rewrite this. This is terrible. This is all like you can't do any of this stuff. Whereas if you're, you know, a writer and you publish this, it's avant-garde, it's revolutionary, things like that. So it's that kind of book. I would definitely like very funny parts, very memorable parts, and very like parts that are pretty, you know, deep and really engaging and emotional. But I'm basically just glad to be done with it. So I
can sometimes it's a chore, I guess, right?
And I can finally say that I have read a Thomas Pynchon. Aside from that, got a few other things I'm working on, but one that I've had for a bit, but I finally started reading, was a book called Africa's World War, Congo, the Rwandan Genocide, and the Making of a Continental Catastrophe. It's by Gerard Prunier.
To be clear, this was your lighter read.
Compared to Gravity's Rainbow, yeah. In terms of style, it's a much easier read. In terms of content, it's a bit heavier. Although Gravity's Rainbow does have to do with, like, Nazi prison camps and concentration camps and stuff.
Oh,
so,
no.
So really, it's just a lot of that type of stuff. This is kind of a topic that I know really just very, very basic stuff about. So reading this is a fairly dense book about it is really interesting. And there's a quote from just page one of it that I wanted to, I think it kind of introduces the opening of the book really well. And Prunier writes, "To understand the complexity of the post-genocide situation in Rwanda, one should imagine a world in which many of the German SS would have had Jewish relatives and in which the post-war state of Israel would have been created in Bavaria instead of the Middle East." So the point he's getting at is the fact that all these things were still intertwined even after, you know, the end of the genocide, the war, what have you, and how since, you know, those things didn't really get resolved, it just spills over into other parts of the continent. And that's kind of the premise of the book, is that a lot of these conflicts in the continent of Africa, it's in many ways one big conflict with these different theaters, or with related pieces spinning off into other things, plus throwing in, you know, the international support. There's a map at the beginning of the quote DRC war, and literally from Libya down to South Africa, this axis through the middle of Africa where everyone is involved in this war in some way, whether it's sending troops, sending supplies, political support, whatever it may be. But it really is a really big, really dense topic that I need to know more about, because it's something that is still going on today in some of its facets. But I think it kind of reminds me of Sally Hayden's book, My Fourth Time We Drowned, in that respect of saying that, you know, these are not, you know, 5, 10, 15 different countries that have independent problems. These are all things that are interconnected, you know, with refugees spilling across borders. And then how does that country deal with that? Yeah, it's a lot. So I'm probably going to be taking it pretty slow.
I kind of like the framing of it with, you know, what if the state of Israel had been in Bavaria instead of the Middle East? Those are like things I can conceive of in my head and think like, huh, that would be a lot different. I wonder what problems would stem from that. And then being able to better understand, you know, that applied to Africa, where I don't know the history of each group quite as well as I may, you know, in a more Western focused example.
That analogy kind of focuses on the geography, but also the fact that, like, you know, it would be death camp survivors, you know, having to go back to their hometown, and the mayor is like a former SS commandant or something.
Yeah, I can see that being problematic.
And you're sort of expected to just like, well, let's just move on.
Right.
And how that rarely is the case.
All right. Well, we are checked in. Let's check out today's shipwreck. Today, we're going to be talking about the RMS Carpathia.
All right.
Have you heard of the Carpathia?
I have, yes.
What, tell me what you know about it.
I know that it was named for the antagonist in the Tim LaHaye, Jerry B. Jenkins series Left Behind.
Uh-huh. That might not be true.
Okay. I'll have to check on that later. I know that she was the ship on scene for, or at least the first ship on scene to rescue people from the Titanic.
Yes, that I feel like that's where most people have heard of the Carpathia. I would imagine that's where everyone's probably heard of the Carpathia before, because when you research it, 75% of the content is how it relates to the Titanic.
Google RMS Carpathia, and it's like, did you mean RMS Titanic?
Did you mean Titanic? Again, this is as close as we'll probably ever get to doing a real Titanic episode. So, the Carpathia was completed for Cunard Line in February of 1903 at Swan Hunter Shipyards in Wallsend, England. Swan Hunter, we've talked about them before. They're a pretty famous shipbuilder, probably one of the most famous shipbuilders, one would say. Some of the other vessels built there include the MV Derbyshire, the RMS Mauritania, and the Esso Northumbria. So kind of some heavy hitters there, some big names.
What's the Northumbria? The Esso Northumbria?
We might talk about that sometime.
Ooh, spoilers.
It's not technically a shipwreck. Great Britain built a bunch of big like super tankers, I think in the 80s, and it was one of them. And they were just a complete failure, kind of for some of the same reasons that the Derbyshire was a failure of just cracking beams, things like that. I don't think they ever actually had a shipwreck or anything, but actually the song Roll Northumbria Roll by
the Dreadnoughts
is about, like, it's fictionalized of like, what if it had had a shipwreck, basically.
I guess in a way, kind of making a smart decision of like, hey, if we put this into practice, it's not going to work.
Yeah, basically. So as we've talked about before, this was a time period where there's pretty intense competition to be the fastest, the biggest, the fanciest. Basically, your goal was to be the EST, like Bianca Belair in WWE. Okay. for the three people that get that joke, you're welcome.
I assumed from the name that that was an adult video star.
It's so funny with WWE names, because they're either, it could all be like a ring name, or a porn star. Alexa Bliss also sounds like a porn star.
Not a lot of Sheamuses in porn that I know of.
I'm on my own against the wall. The pressure's building, but no, I will never fall. Instead of crying, they hear me roar. And now I see that I'm way better than before. I never needed you at all. Think I'll fall down. I'm gonna watch you fall down. I'm living large now.
Cunard's current generation of ocean liners had a reputation for size and speed. However, you know, this is not stagnant. Like we said, this is a time of innovation, and there is that arms race to always be the EST. Mm-hmm. Because of that, White Star Line builds the RMS Oceanic, and North German Lloyd, would you like to read this name, builds the
Kaiser Wilhelm der Große.
That one. In response to these vessels, Cunard decides that they're actually not going to play that game anymore. They build the Ivernia Saxonia. Is it Saxonia?
The Mr. Saxo Beat.
Is it Saxonia?
I would say Saxonia.
Saxonia?
The Stankonia.
So in response to these vessels, Cunard decides to break the mold, and they build the Ivernia Saxonia. In response to this, Cunard decides to break the mold and build the Ivernia, Saxonia, and the Carpathia. The goal of these vessels is not to compete to be the fastest or biggest, but actually a fun new thing, the most efficient. They begin to target transatlantic immigrants who wanted a cheaper ticket, and they focus their efforts more on fuel savings rather than speed. This was partially in an attempt to fight a takeover from J.P. Morgan's International Mercantile Marine Company. I think we've touched on them before.
I remember that came up. Maybe it was when we talked about, I don't know if it would have been the Atlantic episode, but there was one for sure where it came up, and I had no idea that J.P. Morgan almost owned like
every
all
shipping
Atlantic
company.
Shipping. Yeah.
Yeah. He tried. So Carpathia was actually a half-sister to the Ivernia class, which was composed of the other two vessels that I mentioned just a second ago.
They had different father ships.
Yeah, they had different daddy ships. The main difference being The Carpathia was around 40 feet shorter than her sisters. The Carpathia came in at a length of 558 feet. She had a beam of 64 feet, 6 inches, and a draft of 34 feet, 7 inches. It's interesting to note that her speed, her kind of operational speed, is at 14 knots. Mm-hmm. And I looked it up. Titanic had a service speed of 21 knots. So that kind of lets you see right there, like, that adds up over the course of that voyage, the 7 knots. Again, that's not our goal, though. Our goal is to be cheap, not fast.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen what speed gets you with the Titanic.
So originally, she would be able to carry around 1,700 passengers before being reconfigured in 1905 to carry 2,550. It's interesting seeing the class breakdown. After her refit, she had 100 first-class passengers, 200 second-class, and 2,250 third-class. So definitely, again, focused on the third-class passengers.
Trying to get people on there cheap.
They're the Carnival cruises of transatlantic journeys.
I was going to say, like, the Southwest Airlines.
That too. Also South, or maybe even Frontier. Note that she didn't even have a first class prior to her refit in 1905. It wasn't even an option.
So just had the two classes.
You pretty much had the second class and then everybody else.
Did they call them second class and everybody else? And
that
just
would,
like,
be funny. Just, yeah, like, we want you to know this is still not first class.
Yeah.
With this breakdown, you can see that their focus was on immigrant travel rather than high-end customers or pleasure travel, that kind of thing. They're focused on tourists with a small budget that just want to get across and do, like, explore Europe, and people trying to immigrate to North America from Europe. There was a crew of around 300, six of which would have been officers. I'm assuming they're just talking about, like, bridge officers at that point. It should be noted that although she was considered a bit of a mid-tier liner, the interior was still really well appointed and comfortable. Again, this isn't the palatial opulence of the Titanic or the Britannic or something like that, or even the Lusitania, where we've talked about, you know, how palatial she was.
Or the Noronic.
Yes. In particular, her third class accommodations were exceptionally comfortable for the time. So I kind of like that. They chose something to focus on and said, well, we don't need to make it, you know, steerage. We want to try to make this a legitimate experience at a reasonable price. Mm-hmm. It's noted that the third class dining saloon was appointed in polished oak and teak. There was also a smoking room, ladies room, and other amenities not typically expected on a third class ticket. So I thought that was pretty cool to see that basically any facility the second and first class passengers had, the third class passengers also had a version of that.
It's kind of funny to see a specific area designated for smoking, but I assume that means more like a lounge. Kind of a comfy place to sit and smoke. I assume you could probably smoke everywhere.
I would assume you could basically smoke everywhere. I think, yeah, I do believe the smoking room is more like when you only want to smoke with the boys. Mm-hmm. Then you send the women folk to the ladies room.
There's probably like a pool table in there.
You can probably buy a bunch of cigars, that kind of thing. You haven't seen your kid in like 4 days because you just sent him off with a steward somewhere. And like, you'll worry about that later. So another important creature comfort on the Carpathia is that she used electric fans to provide ventilation to the lower levels of the vessel. This acted as a climate control system, offering heating and cooling depending on the season. So I thought that was kind of cool, too.
Is that something of a unique feature at this time? Is this something that I'm not a lot
definitely
of
reads
have?
That this would be something fairly new. It's more about it being controlled in the bowels of the ship versus the upper decks have always, you know, I think they've always had a little ability to do that. But it's circulating that stale air in the midsections in the third class areas. Again, kind of another thing of, well, you know, we're not going to treat you like your animals. We're going to, we're going to have a little dignity with your third class ticket.
Well, and I can see that having other benefits, too, because it's like we see stories with these big liners where it's like you've got people opening portholes for some level of ventilation. And I don't know, maybe if you've got some internal, you've got fans and stuff like that, maybe it makes it a little bit safer also.
So Carpathia would make her maiden voyage on May 5th, 1903, from Liverpool to Boston. From there, she would sail between New York and various Mediterranean ports. Carpathia quickly developed a reputation for being an exceptionally comfortable ship. This, in part, was due to her being a bit of a thick vessel. She had a generous breadth-to-length ratio, and that helps her ride better through the seas. She's a thick girl. She was also able to avoid issues that plagued many vessels with large engines, such as the Lusitania, with engine vibration. That's something I know that was noted with Lusitania, is that she was not a comfortable ship. And also, like we've heard stories with the stability issues that Lusitania had. This is about as far opposite of that as you can get. The summer months found the Carpathia operating between New York and Liverpool, while winter she would shift south and run between New York and the Mediterranean. So, not a bad setup, really. A partnership with the Hungarian Royal Sea Navigation Company in 1904 found the Cunard vessel contracted to Hungarian immigrants. This prompted Cunard to renovate the vessel in 1905, as we previously mentioned. So I really feel like Cunard's just trying to find a way to make money. And I guess one of the ways they find to do it is to sign contracts to haul a bunch of Hungarians to North America.
That'll be 6 shillings, please.
If I said you had a beautiful body, would you hold it against me? I am no longer infected.
May I?
Yeah.
It costs six shillings.
So I thought that was interesting that specifically is kind of what she's assigned to do. And apparently she does it for a long time.
All the Hungarians you see hanging out in cities in the United States, it's Cunard's fault.
When you go visit Little Hungary.
Little Budapest.
So, April 11th, 1912, found the Carpathia departing New York on a typical run to Fiume in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which is now Rijeka, Croatia. At the time, she carried 128 first-class passengers, 50 second-class passengers, and 556 third-class passengers. Important to remember here, she is traveling from New York to Europe. So this is pretty much what we'd expect to see. She's not full, not even close to full. It's people traveling for pleasure or something like that more likely than someone actually moving their life. Although nowhere near as exclusive as Titanic's passenger list, the Carpathia did have a few notable people for this voyage. The artists Colin and Emma Cooper were on board. I was reading a little bit about them. Colin specialized in architectural paintings of buildings in New York, Chicago, and Philly, along with some places in Europe. And Emma was part of the realism movement. I was looking at some of her. She has some really cool landscapes and things that she painted that I thought were pretty interesting. So both of them, obviously, after the events that we're going to go through here, also tend to focus a little bit on Titanic art. Another notable, amongst others that were on there, is Russell Brown, the former governor of Rhode Island. So, again, not quite a Vanderbilt or anything like that, but still good company.
Nothing wrong with being the governor of Rhode Island.
It's the smallest state, but they got some heart, right? I've never even met someone from Rhode Island, I don't think.
I don't think so, but since I've become a Providence fan, I do care a lot more about Rhode Island.
I think the movie Dumb and Dumber starts in Rhode Island.
Yeah, they're from Providence, yeah.
Yeah, that's all I know about Rhode Island right there.
Wonderful ambassadors for the state of Rhode Island.
This brings in one of our main characters for today, at least for this part of the story, the Carpathia's wireless operator, Harold Cottam. His shift had just ended at midnight, just as April 15th, 1912, rolled around. Harold decided that he was going to stay up and listen to wireless traffic. I guess because it's 1912 and there's nothing else to do.
So, like, basically the same thing he was doing anyway.
Pretty much, yeah. I think he just figured, why not, right?
You got to have some division between your work and your hobbies.
I do feel like at the time, wireless is still new, so it's probably just fun to even be a part of it. So it probably doesn't feel like work, necessarily. And it is such a specialized skill. So while listening, he gets a message from Cape Cod, Massachusetts, that there's a private message for Titanic. I thought that was interesting how that worked, that a shore station would just broadcast this message out, and then whoever got it would pass it along, basically.
So they're getting a message from Cape Cod.
Mm-hmm. For the Titanic.
That they're supposed to relay to the Titanic? Is that?
I think they're just supposed to relay that there is a message and that they need to get a hold of Cape Cod.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Because at 12:11, Cottam decides to alert Titanic that Cape Cod has a message for her. And the response to that is definitely not what he's expecting to hear. Cottam is surprised to hear a distress call stating that Titanic has struck an iceberg. Cottam then took the message to the bridge and alerted the officer on duty, who was initially skeptical of the emergency. By all accounts, this really pissed off Cottam, and he said, "I'll go wake up the captain." And he proceeds to wake up Captain Rostron himself. Despite the initial scolding he receives from the captain, the seriousness of the situation is quickly understood. While getting dressed, the captain called for the chief engineer to
call another watch of stokers and make all possible speed to the Titanic, as she's in trouble.
The captain also ordered the heating and hot water to be turned off so he could direct all possible steam to the engines. He's trying to squeeze every bit of that, was it 12 knots per hour? Is that what it was?
I think it was 14.
That's right. All 14 knots out of her. At that time, Rostron believes that they're about 52 nautical miles away. It should be noted that Rostron has a somewhat unique opinion on the changing nautical world and kind of the role that technology has in it. From his autobiography published in 1931, he stated,
"There's a proverb that you can't teach old dogs new tricks, but all I can say is that any senior man who's incapable of assimilating a working knowledge of all the latest and most up-to-date gadgets in use on board the floating palaces had better swallow the anchor and moor up on shore. The sooner, the better."
I think that's kind of a refreshing take on things. How often do we see these guys just cling on to tradition and everything?
Mm-hmm.
I think it also helps in this case that he doesn't question the radio guy once he realizes like what the stakes are. He's like, no, this is like an important piece of technology. It works. Let's act on it. Whereas other captains would probably be like, quit playing with that thing and, go to bed. So while making their way to Titanic's position, Captain Rostron orders additional preparations to be made. One doctor is assigned to each class of dining saloons. So I guess if you're in the third class one, you're going to be busy. Blankets and mail sacks were prepared for survivors, and ladders are also prepared to attempt to pick survivors out of the water. So they're doing everything they can to get bedding and, warm, dry blankets, that kind of thing. In the midst of all this, Cottam sends a message to Titanic stating that they're expected to be on location in about 4 hours. He then held off in sending any further messages in order to leave the air clear for Titanic. I thought that was pretty smart as well, not knowing how much or how little Titanic was going to use their wireless to not do anything to try to interfere with that.
I spent so early in the use of radio from ship to ship.
Around 2:45 a.m., Carpathia began to enter the ice field. That's something I've never really thought about in the Titanic story, is all of these ships coming to rescue her know that there's ice around. So you're sailing towards the ice.
I know on a couple episodes that came up of Titanic Talk Line. I think Alexia covered that a few times with guests of kind of the danger that these ships were putting themselves in or the Carpathia was putting herself in to full head of steam toward the Titanic.
You could do the California thing and be like, maybe.
Kind of busy right now.
So over the course of the next 4.5 hours, Carpathia would pick up 705 survivors. Those rescued were directed to the dining saloons where they were given blankets and hot coffee.
So I assume she's doing this with her lifeboats.
I don't know the logistics of it. They haul on the lifeboats of the Titanic because they bring them actually with them. I'm assuming that you can hook them up to your like deployment system, like, and raise them up, because they would use lifeboats, for drills and stuff. They would sometimes actually put them in the water.
Oh, yeah. I guess everyone who's surviving the Titanic is already in a lifeboat.
Yeah, that's just it. Like, you're not picking people out of the water necessarily. I don't know how all that breaks down, but pretty much they're rescuing people from lifeboats.
Even that, being able to get people from lifeboats onto your ship is pretty impressive, just given the amount of difficulty that you see in these stories with operating the lifeboats, even in relatively calm conditions of deploying and getting them back in.
Yeah, I think the fortunate thing here is like it is an exceptionally calm and nice night. Despite being cold, the weather itself is good. Throughout the rescue process, the Carpathia's passengers generously gave support to the survivors. offering food, warm clothes, and in many cases, just someone to talk to. There was quite a bit of that. I was reading about that. A lot of the passengers were played as kind of just a friend as much as anything, of helping people kind of process what had just happened in the last 4 or 5 hours. Around 9 a.m., it was determined that all lifeboats in the area had been accounted for, and the captain gave the order to move away from the scene. I thought this little incident right here that I'm about to talk about is weird. I don't get it. Around this time, the nearby vessel SS Birma wired the Carpathia and asked if she needed any supplies. Carpathia responded, "Shut up," due to Birma not using a Marconi wireless. I don't know if they didn't have the right wireless set to communicate, or if Carpathia and their crew are just tired after being up all night, but I found that to be odd that a vessel tried to help and they were like, no, absolutely not.
I just went to the Wikipedia page, so I don't know. I need to pursue this further, but this is attributed by Canon to be a part of Marconi's wireless telegraph company policy not to provide information to ships that did not use Marconi wireless sets. So, like a business thing?
Do you have a book? Do you have a book of what ships have it and don't have it?
Maybe there's something in the system that makes it very clear that something's a Marconi or not.
I mean, that, or I guess if they're trying to use lights or flags to signal, maybe they were like, no, use your wireless. Oh, you don't have one? Don't talk to us. It kind of feels like the private fire department thing where it's like, no, yeah. We're just going to watch your house burn down instead of put this out.
I'm going to need a little bit of cash before I get involved here.
So at first, the captain of the Carpathia wanted to drop the survivors off at Gibraltar, as this would incur the least cost to Cunard. However, after consulting with Bruce Ismay, it was decided to make their way to New York. I think it's kind of funny that the captain at first is like, well, we're going to keep kind of going the direction we're supposed to go now. Enjoy Gibraltar.
We see that happen in the Great Lakes, where it'll be like someone's picked up off of, Whitefish Point or something, and they end up in Duluth because that's where the ship was going. But It's like, this is a much, much longer distance to just be taken on the way.
News of the disaster traveled faster than the Carpathia. And she was the subject of intense media and popular interest when she arrived in New York. She was basically Kate Middleton. The Carpathia was flooded with wireless messages from families trying to account for family members, and from media organizations offering money in exchange for information. Can you imagine the devil and the angel talking on your shoulder on that one? When it's like, yeah, we'll wire you $1,000. So just tell us what you know. That has to be tempting. But
especially because it's going to get out eventually. Someone's going to get money for it.
I would imagine if you're the wireless operator on the Carpathia, you're not making big money. I'm sure you make a wage, but I don't know. I'm glad to see that they were of high moral character and did not do that.
Mm-hmm.
Rostron actually orders that no information be shared and deferred to White Star Line, as Cottam was transmitting all known information to the White Star Liner Olympic. So I kind of like that. They put, they just basically dumped all the info over to White Star and said, here you go. This is your problem.
In that sense, rather than just reporting this out to the general public, Cunard just giving that and working with White Star Line to do that, I feel like is a slightly more admirable business move than, say, Marconi refusing to
allow ships to communicate
in an emergency situation.
So on April 17th, the light destroyer USS Chester began escorting the vessel and accompanied her into New York Harbor. During this time, Cottam was assisted by the surviving assistant wireless operator from the Titanic, Harold Bride, in transmitting the names of rescued third-class passengers. So I think that's interesting. They put the wireless guy from the Titanic to work. Probably a lot to do, so I imagine it was probably nice to have an extra set of hands in there to get work in.
Someone else who knows how to use this thing.
Good thing it was a Marconi set. Carpathia would finally arrive under gloomy weather late on April 18th. This next part is something I did not know. The third-class passengers were sent to Ellis Island via tenders in order to undergo health screenings.
So these are the third-class passengers from the Titanic.
Correct. Okay. Yes. So you survive the Titanic and you get to go to Ellis Island while the second and first class people stay on the ship. Just in case you thought you were the same as them. She would then proceed to the White Star dock to unload 13 of the Titanic's lifeboats before ultimately docking at the Cunard dock to disembark the survivors. I'm not sure why all this couldn't be done at the White Star dock, but apparently that's how it went down. The Carpathia and her crew received numerous accolades in the aftermath of the Titanic sinking. Captain Rostron was knighted by King George V, and he was the dinner guest of President and bathtub aficionado William Howard Taft, where Taft presented him with the Congressional Gold Medal.
Now, the bathtub, the custom-built bathtub part is true, correct? It's just that
he never
got stuck in his bathtub.
That we know of for sure. I think that was some political
accusations,
but I do believe he had a custom-built bathtub.
He's a big guy. Yeah,
he was a large man, big boy. They grow him big in Ohio.
Especially for the time. I mean, today, modern America, he probably pretty
probably a normal dude.
Yeah.
It's like when you see the carnival things from like the 1910s and it's like the world's largest man and they're like 280 pounds. So the crew of Carpathia were issued a bronze medal, officers a silver medal, and the captain a gold medal. And another accolade to the captain was given by the unsinkable Molly Brown, who gave him a silver cup and another gold medal. The man had some gold medals.
Okay.
I feel like getting knighted is the coolest one out of any of these. If I'm going to pick one, like, make me a knight.
Did the unsinkable Molly Brown just have a supply of medals to be giving out?
She was rich, so probably, like, had access to medals, right? She had a medal guy. That will conclude the Titanic portion of our program.
All right.
Like so many other vessels that we've talked about, Carpathia was pressed into service during World War I. It's actually kind of funny to think about that if the Titanic hadn't sank due to an iceberg, there's a real non-zero chance that Germany sinks her in World War I.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I know that's something that has been discussed before. She probably would not have had a long operational life regardless of what happened.
So her primary task is to move American and Canadian troops from North America to Europe. Nothing new there. We've talked about this before with ships.
I was just thinking, though, if like Walter Schwieger, like he pulls up and instead of sighting the Lusitania, he sights the Titanic. But he's like a White Star Line fanboy. And he's like, I can't sink it. And like, that's the alternate history is I can't do it. I can't pull the trigger. He can't sink it, sir. He's woke.
I think Schwieger could have pulled the trigger. July 15th, 1918, found the Carpathia departing Liverpool bound for Boston, carrying, I don't know why I said Boston like that, carrying 57 passengers Boston. And 166 crew. Mark Wahlberg came out for a second. This is the opposite of what we previously saw with westbound voyages. Mm-hmm. So why might that be? What's your guess?
Many times I've been asked this question on the podcast. It's World War I.
Absolutely. It's World War I, which totally flips the way that people are traveling across the Atlantic. A lot less willingly in this case. The Carpathia was part of a convoy that ran a zigzag course, and they actually did have an armed escort to deter submarine attack. However,
not very well, apparently.
Early in the morning of July 17th, the escort split up. And along with half of the convoy, the escort proceeds to a different location. I couldn't figure out where the other part split, but this isn't uncommon that the convoy kind of leaves together and then you split when you have to. Carpathia, along with six other vessels, continue to trek westward. Carpathia is now the largest ship in the convoy. And as such, the convoy kind of forms around her, for the zigzags and everything. She's going to probably take the longest amount of time to complete each move, so everyone kind of has to be based around her. Around 9:15, while in the southwestern approaches, a torpedo is sighted off of her port side. Engines were thrown into full reverse, and rudder turned hard to the starboard, but to no avail. The torpedo impacted the number 3 hatch on the port side. This was followed by a second torpedo that hit the engine room, killing 5 people in there instantly. This crippled the vessel and left her deep in the water. It also left her wireless inoperable, and the vessel had to use flags to communicate with the rest of the convoy. I thought that was kind of interesting that a vessel that is probably most famous for its wireless was unable to use its wireless to issue a SOS or anything.
That is a bit ironic.
She then fired some distress rockets in order to attract the attention of a nearby patrol boat. As the rest of the convoy sailed away in order to avoid falling victim to the same submarine. Seeing that the Carpathia was beginning to settle by the head and list severely to port, Captain Prothero gave the order to abandon the ship. Yeah, it's interesting. Note: this is not the same captain. This is not the Titanic captain.
Right.
This is a new one. All passengers and crew were loaded into 11 lifeboats. The exception to this was the captain, chief officer, first officer, second officer, and the gunners, who stayed aboard to destroy sensitive documents and equipment. Upon completing this task, the captain signaled one of the lifeboats to come alongside, and the remainder of the survivors escaped the sinking liner. At this point, there's one little bit of tension left. They finally come face to face with their attacker, U-55. She surfaced and showed herself before firing a third torpedo, which impacted the Carpathia's gunner's room, resulting in a massive explosion that finally finished off the vessel. She would go down around 11 a.m., about 120 miles west of Fastnet Light.
I know the U-boats want to be basically surfaced as much as possible as they operate, so I'm assuming at this point they kind of figured mission accomplished. Yeah. We're safe, we can surface and put another one in her.
Pretty much, like, they've evacuated, and I'm sure that they're watching with Periscope to, oh, it looks like they've all evacuated, because we've talked about that before, that a lot of U-boat captains were perfectly fine with letting a vessel evacuate once it was established what was going to happen. So it appears to be the case here that they gave them a chance to get off. However, after finishing off the Carpathia, the U-55 began to approach the lifeboats, and that's not always something that I don't think we've seen happen. Mm-hmm. And I do think I've read stories of that ending positively and negatively for everyone involved.
Right.
Unclear what the motivation was here, because just as she nears them, the sloop HMS Snowdrop appears and drives the U-boat away with gunfire. And that's another thing that we've noted is that these U-boats don't want to stay and fight. Like, they're not going to get into a back and forth engagement. They definitely want to conceal themselves and run at the first real threat. Snowdrop would then proceed to pick up the survivors in lifeboats once the scene was secure. Snowdrop would then drop them back off in Liverpool on the evening of July 18th. I thought this was interesting that this had been a really cruel few weeks for Cunard Line. Carpathia was the fifth vessel lost in the last 5 weeks, reducing the Cunard fleet from 10 vessels at the start of the war to 5. That's pretty crazy to lose half of your fleet in a week, or in 5 weeks.
I know we've discussed some of the sort of the requisition process that the government used for these, but did they get compensated for those?
I'm not sure of what, like, the kind of behind the scenes thing there is. I'm sure that there was something, as these are being used for military purposes.
I'm sure they didn't get like a full reimbursement for them, but like I feel like they would have had to say, like, okay, yeah, this happened, we'll pay a little bit of money for this.
And I'm sure, you know, later, I think we've talked about it before with kind of the history of these, of how much injection of government money eventually goes into White Star and Cunard and all that, so I'm sure there's a little bit of that going back and forth.
Well, and then I also know that, like, some of the North German Lloyd and the what's the other big German one,
Hamburg?
Yeah, the Hamburg America line. I know a lot of those ships are seized and given to these companies
as like war reparations. So we're going to jump a little ahead in time now to the year 2000.
All right.
In the year 2000, author and explorer Clive, what's his name? Clive, what's the guy that writes? I didn't write his name in here for some reason. The guy that writes all the adventure books.
Clive Cussler?
That's the one. Yeah, he's involved in this.
Okay.
In 2000, author and explorer Clive Cussler announced that his exploration organization had located the wreck in about 500 feet of water and exactly where it was supposed to be, about 120 miles west of Fastnet Light.
Right where they left it.
Right where U-55 left it. I didn't realize that he was like an actual ocean explorer.
Who, Clive Cussler?
Yeah.
Yeah, he does a lot of like undersea exploration stuff.
Have you read his
book? That's it. Is he still alive?
He died in 2020 at 88.
I read one of his in high school. The one about Vikings in Canada. Is it called Valhalla Rising, I think? Let's see. Clive Cussler. Valhalla. Yes, it is. It's Dirk Pitt, number 16, Valhalla Rising. A plot to monopolize North American oil and natural gas production leads to terror attacks on two ocean liners that have newly installed revolutionary engines.
Interesting.
We could read that for our book club.
I have not read any of his work.
Yeah, I don't remember enjoying it particularly because I didn't read any more of them.
So yeah, his exploration team is actually the one that locates this. I thought that was interesting. And now we get to something that makes me angry.
Okay.
Currently, the wreck is owned by Premier Exhibitions, which also operates its subsidiary, RMS Titanic Inc. I have a weird feeling about an exhibition company owning a shipwreck just because it's related to the Titanic.
This is the same company that runs the, I think most people just call it Body Worlds, but the Bodies Expedition with the the plastinated corpses.
Yes, that is them. Merchants of Death.
That is a pretty cool exhibit, honestly. Although I did see it in high school when I probably wasn't paying as much attention to the ethics of it. Oh, God. What? I'm on the Wikipedia page for Bodies, the exhibition. Concerns have been raised by human rights advocates that the bodies are those of executed Chinese prisoners and that the families of the victims have not consented. The exhibitionist claimed that the presumed origin of the bodies and fetuses relies solely on the representations of its Chinese partners and that they cannot independently verify that the bodies do not belong to executed prisoners. Catholics also had high levels of concern about allowing children to view displays containing human remains.
Great. That's already making the case for what I'm about to read. To be clear, these are some of the scummiest people in the shipwreck world whose meal ticket is tied directly to exploiting the Titanic for profit.
Okay.
I don't think there's any conceivable way you can run a publicly traded company and claim it's for education and honoring the memory of those lost. Mm. If anyone from that company happens to be listening, I hope you have a bad day. Listen, I'm well aware that we have a Patreon and ask for money and talk about shipwrecks, and sometimes we laugh and have fun. What I don't do is worry about my stock prices and how it relates to how I'm exploiting the Titanic and its artifacts.
We need to exploit more.
So that just has me a little sketched out. I don't know. In no way should anything they do be considered preservation. Nothing that like you'd expect from a museum or a historical society. Again, places that charge money so you can come see artifacts. Like, it's not the money thing to me. It's how you're doing it and how much you're trying to squeeze out of it.
Right.
You know, like so many other parts of the Titanic story, every bit of it's meant to just squeeze every dollar and cent you can out of it.
Yeah.
It's seeing the Titanic thing at Gatlinburg. It's just not for me. I get it. If it's your thing, no judgment here. It's just not for me.
It's like, it's not what you're doing. It's you know, the way it's being used for financial purposes. Sort of like having an iftar meal, something you can totally do with your friends, with your family, and you should do with your friends and family. But charging $1,000 a plate or $200 a plate, whatever it was, is less good. That will get people angry at you.
Linking Sean King and Premier Exhibitions together, it's sort of the same. They both try to exploit tragedy.
Probably work very well together.
They probably would.
This is a diversion since we're nearing the end of it, but I was talking to Katie about Sean King, and Sean King is interesting because there is something of the 1800s huckster in him.
There is.
Where you know, it used to be, you know, before mass media communication, you could just pull up your stakes, move like a county or two over, and just restart your grift. And, you know, before people caught wind of it, that's much, much harder to do in the internet age. Mm-hmm. Information spreads faster, your face spreads faster. But somehow Sean King manages to get into every little, you know, social movement and start up again, regardless of what cause it is, until people finally, you know, enough people finally spread the word about him to say, okay, we should not be interacting with this guy. And he manages to do it. Like, he is devoted to the game. You got to give him that.
So the last 3 or 4 minutes ranting here, this is why we don't often stray into Titanic territory, is because A, I don't think there's a lot of new things to add to it. And B, I get sketched out when there's just this much exploitation going on.
And because it's boring and it sucks.
Because there's better shipwrecks. Right. But Carpathia has an interesting story. And I don't know. I think it's something that should be shared. She is more than just the vessel that picked up the survivors of the Titanic.
Yeah, she has something of, we've made this comparison already, but she has something of the Arthur M. Anderson. They're mm-hmm. sort of like brethren in the sense that both of them are fairly run-of-the-mill vessels, you know, for their era and what they do. And they're remembered, at least figuratively, forever because they're associated with some of the most famous ships in history, at least from a shipwreck perspective.
So a couple other little things here. Let's talk about the fate of the U-55. Unlike many of the U-boats we talk about on here, the U-55 actually survives the war, and she's impounded by the Royal Navy and held at Scapa Flow. We've kind of talked about that. Maybe they made a Seagull gun. Who knows? Mm-hmm. Ultimately, she was given to Japan as part of her spoils of war.
Don't give it to them.
Japan was on the winning side of World War I, and they got some of the sweet, sweet loot.
Walter White pressing his face against a window.
Surely Japan just wants this submarine for peace, right? Actually, this submarine does not last until World War II.
I would assume they wouldn't be able to use it.
Yeah, it's gone by like the 20s, but you know, it probably helped train someone who did something horrible later on. So wrapping it all up, despite acting as a major supporting character to the most famous shipwreck in history, I don't think many people know the full story of the Carpathia. What I find so interesting about this vessel is not that it's unique. Mm-hmm. We've talked about so many vessels that have had similar careers and were lost in war. But there's always something special about a vessel that's attached to the Titanic story. So, I don't know. This is a little slice of the Titanic story that I thought maybe we could add a little bit to, share a little bit about, have some thoughts on. And I don't know. It's worth knowing, I guess, that the Carpathia is another one of these ships that's a victim in World War I. And there's 5 guys that didn't come back from that journey. And I don't think many people know that about the Carpathia.
So are those 5 killed in that explosion? Are those the only casualties of the Carpathia sinking? Yeah,
it's just the initial torpedoing, which is surprisingly common in a lot of these sinking stories, that if it's not a kill shot right away, usually if you weren't killed in the initial blast, you made it off the vessel.
Yeah, this was, I didn't know what happened to the Carpathia after the Titanic story.
I mean, I think a lot of people just don't care, right?
If you had asked me, like, hey, what happened to the car? I probably would have guessed she served in World War I and probably was sunk by a U-boat, but it's a great story, an interesting story.
Yeah, really good. So I think that'll do it for this one. Did you want to tease anything for next week, or are you going to leave it a mystery?
I have got, let's see, what I'm working on for next week, where it's going to be a much more, basically, then also next week, we're going to be recording some bonus episodes. I mentioned that sort of expansion on the Princess Victoria that's still coming as one of the bonuses. And then I think for the $5 tier bonus, we'll have a look at the Black Star line.
Nice.
Since we've been talking about White Star and Cunard, be interesting to look at another line attempting to operate sort of in the same ecosystem for a relatively brief amount of time. But there's a lot of interesting politics and social and cultural things going into the Black Star line. We'll have to talk a lot about Marcus Garvey, who's a fascinating figure from, I guess, not even necessarily just American history, but Atlantic history, you know, Caribbean history also. So a lot of fun things to talk about there.
Awesome. Cool. Well, we will wrap this one up. Hope everybody has a great week and hope you enjoy the episode. And we will talk to you next week. Thanks for listening.